I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. No one ever said it was easy to raise a teenager, but what do you do when Plan B becomes Plan A? This hour, psychologist Wes Crenshaw returns to our studios to talk about teen sexuality and how parents can handle the accompanying issues like the morning after pill, otherwise known as Plan B. Later, we'll look at different ways to have a harmonious home when your college-age kid returns for the holidays. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. In November, the American Academy of Pediatrics urged doctors to offer prescriptions for Plan B. That's the morning after pill for girls under 17. Girls can't get this form of contraception over the counter. Psychologist Wes Crenshaw joins us today to discuss how parents should respond to this and other trends in teen sexual health. Then later this hour, we'll also talk briefly about how to handle teens and young adults who are home for the holidays. Yes, this can disrupt well-entrenched family patterns. Dr. Wes Crenshaw co-authors the Double Take Advice column for teens and their parents in the Lawrence Journal World, and he's the author of two books, Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Teens and Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens. And Wes, always good to have you here.
And
happy holidays to you.
Great to be back. I'm a little scratchy on the throat, but I'll try to sound smooth.
We'll get there. Before we get rolling here, what happens to traffic coming through your office this time of year, Wes?
Yeah, let's just say that you can't get an appointment with me until about the 14th of January.
No kidding. And why is that?
Well, there's a number of factors that come into play. You know, I'm in a college town, and so finals just ended. And that's a big part of it, but also for the high school students. A lot of people don't realize this, and it took me a number of years to really figure it out working in Lawrence. And that is that the fall semester is really the killer semester. Spring is easier, and people think, yeah, that makes sense. It's spring, and it's pretty and nice. That's not really the reason. Fall semester, the Thanksgiving holiday, is short, and it falls at a weird time in the semester. And so you get out of Thanksgiving, you're barely pulling yourself together, and you immediately have papers due and finals just in those few days between the end of Thanksgiving and Christmas break. In the spring, you know, you have spring break, and although some people use spring break for things I might not think are too wise in Panama City or something, it does give them an actual break, and it happens earlier in the semester. So in the fall, this is just really where people are struggling with school, and on top of that, you have a fair amount of frustration and anxiety, especially in the young adults, coming home, getting ready to deal with parent issues. And those range from issues of how much control parents continue to have over their kids when they're in college.
When they come back home,
Well, or even, you know, even at college. One of the big debates that always comes up is, do parents, what rights do parents have? If they are paying for the education, or if they're not paying. If a kid is 20 years old, do they have the right to go home with their boyfriend instead of come home for Christmas? And this becomes a big fight. So that's all those kind of things.
We'll get into some of that later on. Let's go back to the whole final exam thing. You know, just looking at my two kids who are both in high school, both dealing with finals right now and talking to their friends, I just see a whole lot of kids just on the edge. I mean, kids are really ratcheted up this time of year as they deal with all of this. And it sort of makes me wonder, our ninth graders, our 10th graders, are they too young to sort of deal with this kind of pressure, or am I reading way too much into all this?
It's kind of interesting. We are perennial complainers about our educational system. And I think we got this idea in the 90s that the Chinese were coming for us. They were going to march onto our
and they're whipping us.
Yeah, yeah. And take over our science and math and reading and such. And we got into this idea that the educational system is failing us. And if you go back 40, 50, 60 years, you'll see one year after another how the educational system is failing us. Well, that doesn't even make sense, because which educational system are we talking about? The one in Kansas City is different from the one in Lawrence, is different from the one in Sacramento, and so on. They're all different challenges, so you can't say that. But apart from that, we've gotten in our heads that we really have to push kids really hard. And at the same time, we say, oh, they're lazy and not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've studied your son's curriculum. My daughter's curriculum, who's 15, scares me. It gives me test anxiety dreams.
Oh, I'm all over that. Yeah.
I don't want to think about calculus.
You know, every fall you walk through your kid's schedule at school. They invite everyone, the parents, to come up one evening,
right,
and you walk through your kid's schedule in a very abbreviated sort of way. And I always leave that experience by turning to my wife and saying, how did they manage all this?
You
know, and
so
I guess we did, but I don't remember how I did it either. So
true. And working with kids, and I'm not kidding, every fall I hear their struggles, and we get to the end, and I wait till I get the text from the young people, and it's like, oh, I passed organic chemistry,
yeah,
and I feel this sense of joy. Then I go home, and I have the dream where you are in school, and you have forgotten to go to class, and then suddenly
yeah,
you realize
yeah,
you have to take the final.
Yes, yes.
And I think, what in the world? And the only way I get out of that dream is I remember I have a PhD and I don't need the stupid class, and I escape.
Well, I have that dream at least once a year. It always mm-hmm, it comes up at some point. I'm back there again.
Isn't it odd that sticks with us? And I think this speaks to really how anxiety-producing school is for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we continue to go back to that. That dream, by the way, it's time for dream analysis. That dream is really usually about anxieties in our current life, and we associate that so
sure,
much with
sure,
what we went through in school.
Well, for parents who are listening and who have kids who are in the midst of finals right now, I think so many high school kids are, maybe even some college students, what can you tell parents about how you can sort of work with their kids to deal with what they're up against the next 2 or 3 days here?
Yeah, this goes to the issue of picking what kind of kid you have. If you have a naturally anxious kid, you want to be very comforting. And if you have a kid who leans a little more towards the not caring enough or the, you know, subclinically ADD side,
mm-hmm,
you have to push him a little bit more. And it's like my dear departed dad, the minister, used to say, my job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And so if your child is one of those that's a little too comfortable, you have to push him a little harder. But with a lot of kids this season that are more on the anxious side, just help bring down a calming environment and a low expressed emotion. Yelling at a kid, why didn't you get an A, who's already upset about that,
yeah,
is not going to drive anyone towards success.
Yeah, and I imagine you're seeing kids and parents right now who are dealing with all this.
You bet.
At your, yeah, all
you
right.
Betcha.
Well, let's move on to our other topic today, and I'm wondering about Plan B, which is this morning after pill for girls under 17. And I should point out that you're not a psychologist, Wes, and you're not a medical doctor.
Yep, I am a psychologist.
You are a psychologist, but you're not a medical
right,
doctor. Yeah, it's one or the other. You look like both sometimes, you know. But you work with a lot of teens and families, and as we know from past shows, that includes a lot of discussions about teen sexuality. What should families know about this new guideline from the Academy when it comes to Plan B, the morning after pill?
Well, the first thing to know is, in my world, Plan B is not the Boehner plan for avoiding the fiscal
yes,
cliff.
Lots of Plan Bs these days.
I couldn't believe I woke up this morning and
yeah,
I thought, of all things, that's in the news today. Plan B is really the same medication that's in the Mirena IUD. It's a form of birth control, and it's given in a higher dosage, and its specific purpose is to prevent fertilization. So therefore, you
mm-hmm,
can use it with a fairly high degree of success after what we shall call today exposure, sexual activity exposure. And really, it is a very important change in the world of teenagers. I used to do this interesting kind of brain journey thing with graduate students, and I would ask them, what do you think would be the most significant physiological change that could bring about a new cultural reality for humanity, and you know, they'd think of different things. And my version always was to raise the age at which girls menstruate to about 25. Now, you think I'm kidding, and if you really think about it, that would have a significant effect. And I'm not saying anything mean to the lovely 22-year-old parents that I work with. They do a great job. They're heroes in my book. But your brain finishes developing around 24 to 25 years of age.
And I can't wait,
yeah,
by the way.
For your brain? Yeah, right.
Well, okay. I've just turned 25, okay, as we all know, but no, my kids.
Yeah, yeah, it will be a joy for you, because then they call you up and they're like, oh, gosh, Dad, you were amazing. That's the best part of it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
But if one were to wait that long, be able to wait that long till you could reproduce, I really think that would make a tremendous difference in our culture. So the closest thing that has occurred to that in my experience the last few years is the existence of Plan B. And it really is – I was trying to think if I was certain about this, but I think it is the minority of teenage girls I've worked with in the last 3 years who have not had an encounter with Plan B. If you followed all the double negatives in that, it is fairly commonly used.
Huh.
And so that's made a difference, because it reduces the possibility, likelihood of abortion, and it reduces the possibility of having a child before you are ready. So
yeah,
it's been pretty important, and it's something parents really aren't quite up to speed on a lot of the time.
Now, what's brought this issue into such sharp focus for you in your own professional life, Wes?
Yeah, that was back in 1997, and my wife was pregnant with our daughter, and simultaneously on my caseload, I had four teenage girls that were pregnant. One of them was 13.
Wow.
And that really shook me out of the magnolias, and I got very interested in that.
And just in terms of what it's doing to people's lives and how helpful, in some cases, Plan B can be.
Well, and of course, there was no Plan B at the time. We
okay.
didn't have that option. But in terms of really understanding the importance of managing contraception,
yes.
and I was not alone in that. The birth rate has gone down by 44% amongst teens since 1991.
44%?
That's good news. And I assure you that this was not because of abstinence education. It was because kids have generally mastered contraception.
You know, how often is the issue of emergency contraception coming up for anyone, you know, teens, adults, and how often does that come in the door for you these days?
Oh, every day.
Every day.
You got to remember that there are two foci of adolescence for kids, and we talk about them a lot on the show when we come on. One of them is to individuate from the family of origin, to become who you are as an adult, and the other is to organize your sexuality. And so a lot of the processing that kids do is about dating and relationships and how do you offer yourself in a relationship emotionally. And so this is something that's always on their minds. And I have a rule, which I think will make sense. I just won't talk with kids about dating and sexuality if I think they're at risk of having unprotected sex. So the first discussion really has to be, if that's a topic they want to discuss, and they all do, is to be sure they are protected from disease and pregnancy.
They do want to talk about it.
Oh, yes. They like to talk about that a lot. As you remember, in October, our young women were very, very much like to discuss this. And so this is something that's important to them. And I think it gives us, as healthcare providers, a lot of opportunity to really help them think through all aspects of their choices.
I know we've covered this in the past, but to what extent do you see parents dealing with these issues capably as you work with young people day in and day out?
It's really all over the board. It really has. It used to be that it was, I think, the minority of parents that did this well, and I think there's an improvement in this. You know, I had really an interesting example of this. A couple of months ago, a mom I worked with was struggling with an ethical dilemma that the son had come to her and said, I need Plan B. And of course, I'm sure listeners realize Plan B is not going to do him any good, but mm-hmm. he was concerned about he and the girlfriend. And the girlfriend had not been able to discuss this issue with her mother. Well, the clock is running. Plan B only works effectively as fast as possible, but 72 to 120 hours after exposure. And so this mom had to really decide, was she going to supply this to her son? And she did, but she asked the girl to please talk about this with her mom, which she did do. but I thought this mom just handled this brilliantly. And it was great that she had the kind of relationship with her son where he could come and have what really was an awkward discussion for him with her and get this taken care of together as a family. I thought that was a beautiful story.
Well, if our listeners have had this conversation with their kids, or even if you haven't and you have questions about all of this, Dr. Wes Crenshaw is with us this morning, a great person to ask questions and get some quick advice from. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Let's go to Ben from Kansas City, Kansas. Ben, happy holidays. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. I do sexuality education and therapy in the Kansas City area.
I like you already.
Thank you. One of the things that the misconceptions that I come across a lot in my work about Plan B is that it's frequently known as an abortion pill. And I just wanted to kind of, you know, reiterate that it's not an abortion. That's an entirely separate procedure. Plan B actually prevents a fertilized ova from implanting and even being fertilized in the first place, which is what happens before an abortion even becomes necessary.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I definitely had it on the list of things to talk about, and let's just jump right on it. People confuse this with RU486, and we now have in the United States the legal use of chemical abortion, which is the RU486. That, you're right, has absolutely nothing to do with Plan B.
Mm-hmm.
Where that has gotten mixed up, just so listeners are aware, is that there was a very small and not well-regarded research that indicated that at times the Plan B could cause a fertilized ovum to fail as a pregnancy, which is, by definition, an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
However, the follow-up research, the more extensive research, indicates that is not true. And the I believe it was the New York Times earlier this year in an editorial called upon the FDA to remove that from its literature on Plan B, that this is not something people should be concerned about. So it's a very fine point.
Ben, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
And, of course, that gets politicized.
I was going to say, Missouri Senate candidate Todd Akin made this point that you're making here during the campaign. He believed there was a connection between Plan B and abortion, right?
Yeah. It didn't work out well for him, did it?
No.
This is something that people say, and because a lot of folks in that way of thinking don't even like contraception to begin with. So this one they see as potentially risking an abortion, and this is just not based on science. You know, could it ever happen? I don't know. But it certainly is not a likely scenario, and it's not one that research says occurs.
Well, if you've had what you believe is a successful conversation with your son or daughter about Plan B, the morning after pill for girls under 17, we'd like to hear how it went. 816-235-2888. It might help other listeners who are dealing with all of this right now as well. Again, 816-235-2888, and our email address, up to date, at kcur.org. You know, you wrote in your column a few weeks ago in the Lawrence Journal World West that you know of even very conservative families that have Plan B in the home for kids on a no-questions-asked basis. How do they end up viewing it that way? How does that work?
Well, for the under-17 crowd, for 16 and under, you can't get it yourself without a prescription. Now, there are more workarounds for that than you can imagine, because kids have friends that are 17, so they found some workarounds for it. But for some families, they have concluded that the safest bet, this is sort of like the bowl of condoms that people have kept in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
The safest bet is to have it there and to not, if it disappears one day, you don't say very much. Now, that's not how I would want to do things, but some families have decided that the risk of having an abortion or an unwanted pregnancy is so concerning for them that they want to be sure every avenue is taken. And I think if you're not in a home where these are things that folks discuss easily, that is an alternative one could consider. It is a safe form of birth control.
So no question, the goal here is to have in your family an atmosphere where having open conversations about this is definitely the way to go.
That is always preferable. That's why I liked that and used that example of the story of the mom and the son. That just went really well, in my opinion, because it was them working as a team. Not everybody is going to pull that off. Not every kid is as open. Not every parent is as skilled at bringing that up before you need to. And what is unique and helpful about Plan B is it is a Plan B. It isn't a substitute for Plan A, which is to have a wise set of choices about contraception and about sexual activity to begin with, but it is a backup in the event that is not occurring.
Okay. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Melinda from Lawrence. Melinda, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead, Melinda.
Thanks. My question was, Wes, do you end up talking to people about some potential side effects? I know you're not a physician, but side effects of Plan B, when my boyfriend, who's now my husband, when we had to take it once, it was a miserable experience. Those side effects can really be miserable.
And, Melinda, tell me about that. What kind of side effects are you talking about?
Well, a lot of severe nausea and vomiting for a couple of days. Kind of, I know a lot of women suffer from nausea the first month of birth control pills. So you're taking a lot of hormone over a couple of days, not over a month. Mm-hmm. And they can be really, really miserable. And so when I read people's comments about, oh, you know, these young people could just be using Plan B all the time, I don't think.
Right.
I think that the side effects will make you change the way that you handle your sexuality.
You are on a couple of excellent points.
I'm really glad you called, Melinda. Hang on just for a minute, if you would. Yeah.
Yeah. It's nice to have our Lawrence friends calling up. Here is, you know, when first Plan B came out, I took exactly the tack you are proposing, not simply because it is the right thing to do to apprise people of the side effects of any birth control if you were doing sexual education, but because I kind of wanted kids to think this isn't that great an idea and I should be thinking about this up front. There are two reasons I have somewhat deviated from that. The first is because I have had very few of the responses you did. I know they exist. It absolutely is in the literature that accompanies Plan B that you can have quite a negative reaction to it. But I had decided that the last thing I wanted to do was to discourage kids from going down the path if they needed it. In fact, kids know they have a 24-hour-a-day access to me if they have to have this conversation to think it through.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of bent away from that. The second reason is because there's a different factor that lowers their desire to use it willy-nilly, and that is it's expensive. If you go down to the health clinic at KU, it's only $25, but anywhere else, it's between $43 and $53. And for teenagers, that's a big bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
So they get unreinforced pretty quickly for using it as a common method of birth control. And I do have a kiddo that my record right now is I had a kiddo that used it three times. And every time I sat down with her and I said, what part of this are you not understanding?
Mm-hmm.
This is not a mature way to approach your reproductive health. And she finally got it and has been on contraception for the last 2 years effectively. So there is a punishment that comes with using Plan B. The biggest one is economic, but for some people, you're right. It is you notice you've taken it for 2 or 3 days.
Well, Melinda, I'm really glad you called. That opened up an interesting conversation there. Thanks so much for making the call. Okay, thanks. Let's go to Pat from Overland Park. Pat, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello, I'm calling as a parent who has a daughter who's a senior in high school and a son who's a senior in college.
Ah. Steve and I have special empathy for you.
Actually, it's been fairly smooth. We're in the middle of finals with our daughter, but other than that, we've made it through. Starting at quite an early age, probably middle school and definitely through high school, and then very seriously before college was starting, we had very serious talks with our children about sexuality and sex, and talked everything about maturity levels when it was right for them, what sex meant, what sex didn't mean, emotionally, physically, what you could get pregnant from, what you couldn't get pregnant from, and how important it was if they made that decision to become sexually active, how important it was to have birth control.
Well, you are an A student. You hit the mark.
Well, actually, when I was in college, I was a facilitator for a course called Topics in Human Sexuality.
Well,
I went to an Ivy League school, and they were very dismayed. This was in the 70s, that for a smart group of kids, we had an incredibly high amount of pregnancies.
Yep.
And they started this whole, it was a voluntary course, and I took it, and then I was facilitator. And I thought, when my kids get old enough that this becomes a question in their life, that it's very important. And when it came to things like, Plan B, my feeling is, even if you get morning sickness and some other side effects, it's much less than the consequences of a pregnancy.
Sure, and I don't think Melinda was saying otherwise.
Oh, no, just that people would not be surprised that it's not just you take a pill and everything's fine. And to me, deciding not to be pregnant once you are, to end a pregnancy is, of course, a very personal and a very specific thing to people. But I feel like the whole thought of what it will do to those young people who are getting pregnant, whether they're 13 or 15 or 18 or 20, and what it will do to that baby. To me, is something that, I mean, here in Kansas, we hear all of, the unborn child, which is not, it's a fetus. But no one ever sits down and I feel like if you go into the doctor's office the way they want us to have 24 hours to decide to have an abortion, they should make people who come in thinking of keeping a pregnancy saying, do you know what this is going to do physically, emotionally, your education, your life, are you prepared to be a parent? And those questions never seem to be asked.
Yeah, great points, Pat. And I'm always struck when I talk to someone like you, the question goes through my mind, what percentage of parents actually have had the conversations that you've had with your son and daughter? How old were your kids when you sat them down?
Probably in middle school.
Oh, that early. Wes always talks about...
I mean, we don't go into the nitty-gritty of everything and not like, oh, choose birth control, this and that. But just, part of our philosophy also was, when they ask something, answer it. And answer it based on pretty much their age.
And answer it in a conversational manner. Like, if somebody says, what do you think of the Jayhawks this year? You don't go, the Jayhawks.
Exactly.
Oh, no.
Don't make it into a traumatic thing. You know, in 2004 and 2008, when we had, the last elections and abortion was a big issue, my kids asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
And at school, they've been hearing things like, we're killing babies.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
to me, I thought I had to give some answer. And to me, at each age, you don't go in huge depth. You go into what might be happening in their life. But when you hear about kids who are involved with various sexual activities, even in middle school, I feel like they need information. They need to know. They don't need to do that in their life.
Yeah, I have a novel I'm working on for young adults, and that includes late teens, that really addresses exactly what you're talking about and struggling with this issue. And one of the points I'm making there is also a clinical point that I make. And this is very much this is a Wes-ism. This is my view, is that having worked with kids in foster care, having worked with adoptions, having worked with people who have chosen to have an abortion, I've done that whole picture. And I have come to the conclusion that it is not enough to want to have a baby, sort of. You've got to desperately want to have a baby.
Yeah.
And some people do that in going out and pursuing hundreds of thousands of dollars in fertility.
Yeah.
Other people come to that, fortunately, as my wife and I did. And some people come to it by accident. But it is possible to desperately want a baby you didn't intend to have. I've seen it happen many times. But if you cannot, after you are pregnant, make the decision to desperately want the baby, you really have an obligation to think about what the impact of that is going to be on the child down the road.
Exactly.
And you have a couple of choices there, depending on your perception of moral and ethical choices. But if you don't, then you really have your choice of regrets, and you're going to have to pick which one you can live with. And a child really – I know people are going to think, ugh, what is he, psychic or something. I promise you that children know when they are unwanted. They understand this at a higher level of consciousness I'd have never imagined when I started out.
Someone once asked me, I'm a very happy mother of two, and I'm also pro-choice, and someone once said to me, how can you possibly be pro-choice? You love your children. I said, because I want every child to be as planned for and loved as these two.
Yeah. Pat, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Have a great discussion.
Thank you. Keep it going. Yeah.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.
Coco from Overland Park. Coco, you're on with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just going to make a comment. I've been actually teaching moms and dads to talk with their kids. There's a parent-child class we've been doing here in Overland Park and the metro area for over 20 years with the notion that high school is almost too late.
It is. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And so, and what's fascinating is, and Wes, you probably are familiar with Dr. Daly's work.
You bet.
Who shared that 90% of us will repeat the experience we had growing up. So I often have parents who say, I want to do differently than my parents did, which was they never talked to me about this. And so we, frankly, have to have classes to, you know, encourage parents and kind of model for them, you know, what is the language and what is developmentally appropriate and so forth. And I'm also a social worker at an area hospital on a mother-baby unit. So I see the worst of the baby and sexuality stuff where you have countless unplanned pregnancies, both young women. And I guess one of the big messages I'd like us to push a little bit more is for our young men to realize that they, upon puberty, are fertile 100%, 24/7. And so a piece of the responsibility is, you know, rests with them, but we've really saddled women with that when we're only really fertile for, a couple days a month, and that this is about a relationship and not just about, an activity, if you will.
Yeah.
But it is a conversation that needs to start much younger, but obviously age appropriate. And parents are very, they're scared and they don't know if they're going to say too much or too little or say it wrong. But my gosh, I think most kids will just appreciate that their parents opened up the topic to them, because then at least they know, I can ask my folks about this and they're not going to flip out.
Yeah, right.
And there's no replacement for men, whether they're the fathers or the uncles or, a kind adult. There's no replacement for a young man's experience of having a man in his life who teaches him to be ethical in relationships.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And I do, one of my favorite folks who worked a lot with the sad element of, sexual abuse, she talked about, kids are learning their sexual values from the moment they enter the world in terms of how the family operates, the culture we live in. But really, I think as moms and dads, we often are so quiet or silent or scared that their brain is being filled up with a value about bodies and so forth. And then we want to just flip the switch, in high school and say, don't do this, or here's what you have to do, when already they've been filled with so many really unhealthy images and so forth. So,
Coco, thank you for the phone call. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. We'll talk a little bit about Gardasil, the shot for HPV, and then we'll turn to this whole topic about the kids, college students, coming home for the holidays and how that can disrupt even well-trenched families. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's discussion with UMKC Chancellor Leo Morton, you can find it in our latest installment of our series 90 Mile View at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we're looking at the best in children's literature this year. Also, we'll have our weekend to-do list. This hour, visiting with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He co-authors a Double Take Advice column for teens and their parents in the Lawrence Journal World. He's written a couple of books, Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Teens and Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens. And Wes, before the break, we were talking about Plan B, the morning after pill. I wanted to also bring up, you've written about Gardasil, the shot for the HPV. Do you find that some parents are hesitant to get that vaccine because, it's linked to sexuality and they aren't comfortable with that issue?
Yeah, I think it's gotten better, but we still are struggling with this because people want to sort of put that off until they think their child is about to be sexually active. Mm-hmm. And as we have discussed many times before, this is not a predictable situation. And it's really better to get the shot before the child is thinking about sexual issues when they're 9 or 10 or 11, and then it's not and I shouldn't say when they're not thinking about them, but when they're not probably going to be out having sex at that age.
Well, parents are wondering then, well, how do you explain what they're giving them a shot for at that point?
I think it's a good discussion. I think at that point you say later on down the road when you decide to be sexually active and you hopefully have explained what that means by the time someone is 11 or 12 years of age, this is something that will protect you from a sexually transmitted disease that can cause cervical cancer. And they're now recommending this for boys because they can be carriers. And so you can kind of explain that to boys too. It's nothing you want to hide. It's just that you, if you say when they're 15, if you say we need to get your Gardasil shots, the kid is going to already know about associating that with sex. And it becomes either what do you think I'm doing or the kid is already sexually active and it really isn't. It isn't that it's too late, but you're missing the point in the life curve when you really need to get it done.
So you would broach that conversation how then?
With the child? Well, I would just make it as you get other vaccines that you expect to take, and kids love those, you know. What really interesting, one of the barriers that has become a problem, I'm almost scared to mention this because it is an issue. It hurts. It is actually painful, and you have it's an intramuscular injection, so it goes in the arm. You can't get it in your butt, which is where most people would like to get it because it doesn't hurt. And so girls will get the first one, and they just don't want to, you know, take another one. They don't want to do it. And so you really do have to say this is pretty serious. This is something that can really hurt you someday, and not make it a choice. When kids are younger, they'll have to go through that. And they do things because you say they do it. When you get to be a teenager, you don't like that. You're no convincing. I just had this discussion with a 15-year-old the other day, and I had to lay it on the line. I know what you're doing, and you are exposing yourself to risk. It is significant risk. And she finally said, okay, if you say so.
You know, what percentage – what do we know about the percentage of teens who are getting these shots? And if that number is what the experts expected, or is it running short or ahead of the curve, or where are we?
It's a good question, and I don't know that they collect statistics on that exactly. I think in my experience it is still the majority of people who are getting it. But you run into people who aren't, and it's either usually because the kid has balked or because the parent just cannot, for whatever reason, fathom that their child might be going to be sexually active or already is. And so it's a minority, but it tends to be those minorities that are the ostrich with the head in the sand, although that's not a true thing. Ostriches don't do that.
Well, let's switch topics here just a little bit, Wes. Let's turn to college kids and anyone else, kids out of college coming home for the holidays, because you know this obviously can be a source of considerable tension in the home after the welcome home hugs have passed. So in the time we have left, give us your thoughts for managing teens over the holidays, because kids tend to see holidays different than adults. And before you respond, let's get our listeners to chime in with their own experiences, how they deal with the kids coming home who have been away for a while and how difficult that can be. How do you manage those moments, those days when the kids are home for a while and the family patterns completely are upended? 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. So go back to the whole point, Wes, you know, kids seeing the holiday different than adults do, because I think there are two different worldviews there very much at work.
This is the holiday version of the standard dynamic, the standard conflict between parents and kids, that parents need to do parent things and kids need to do kid things. And these things mustn't overlap, because if the parent's doing kid things, there is no parent, and vice versa. So what we want to see is a hierarchy there. Well, this comes into play in the Christmas, because the parent thing is often to want people to join hands like the Von Trapp family and sing Christmas carols in harmony.
Every hour of every day the kids are home for the holidays,
and
right?
Some people are like, oh, come on, I've never even seen The Sound of Music. I'm not like that. But you have your version of that that is very important, seeing the grandparents. And, you know, that is important if you don't see them very often. Or having this thing, the one I've run into this year is that we have a certain Christmas, and we've always had a certain Christmas, and we're going to have it this exact way. And no, your boyfriends can't come. No, your friend who's a foreign exchange student who's joining us, they can go to Panera. You know, I don't – what are you going to do with them? And it has to be this certain way. And there's an expiration date on some of these traditions for kids. They aren't meaningful anymore. And nobody wants to, you know, hold hands around the Christmas tree at gunpoint. That's not a very good reference this week, probably, you know, to be forced to do that.
Yeah. Yes, right.
They don't want to be made to do something. That's not very festive, is it? And so
– probably not.
At the same time, where kids are in this, doing kid things, it doesn't, in my opinion, mean that kids should just – blow off the parents and say, we don't have to do anything. So there needs to be some negotiation on both sides. And so inviting people to join you for the special Christmas is a good compromise. And realizing that, particularly for the college kids, but also to some degree for later high school kids.
And you mean inviting them for the special Christmas, you mean what exactly?
You know, if you have the boyfriend or girlfriend that wants to come from college or from across town and join you for your Christmas unwrapping.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing that as an invader is just the worst idea. You want to see that person as practice for how you're going to welcome your future son-in-law or daughter-in-law into the home. This is what we're practicing together.
Mm-hmm.
And some folks get so stuck in the past of what was meaningful back then that they miss what a joy it is to welcome new people into their tradition.
And this negotiation you're talking about, parents talking to their kids about what everyone expects here, that should occur, I gather, beforehand, before the trip home occurs?
I wish that it would. It would make my life easier this time of year. I think where kids go wrong, I advise them to do this differently, is they purposely procrastinate and to the point where there's a pressured decision the parent's going to have to make. And then they call them up and they say, I just wanted to let you know that I really want to bring Billy home so you guys can meet him. And maybe the parent's real flexible. But you know what? If the parent was that flexible, they wouldn't have pulled it this way. Instead, it's usually the people they're trying to drop the late bomb on. Well, then the parent, you know, understandably, is kind of resentful of that. You're dropping this on me. I didn't make a plan for it. Mm-hmm. How are we going to discuss sleeping arrangements? You know, we have your aunt and your uncle in town. Where's he, you know, going to sleep on the porch?
Right.
And she says, oh, well, you could sleep with me. And, you know, this is not really a good panic discussion while somebody's at the airport in Boston getting ready to get on a plane with Billy. So that is an error. And kids really, you know, do better when maybe at Thanksgiving. They say
there's a conversation.
I want to have Billy come home for the holidays, et cetera. And then there's the inverse of that. And it, like I say, it happens in high school too, where your child wants to go home for the holidays with somebody else. And if you throw a big fit about that as a parent, there's going to be two possibilities. You're going to have an angry, resentful child to enjoy over the holiday, or they're just going to go anyhow. And then it becomes an issue of unnecessary tension. So you have to talk about how can we all get our needs met as young adults and as parents. And again, that can be high school kids too.
Handling teens and young adults who are home for the holidays, the issues that arise is our topic right now with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. How does your family negotiate what can be these very difficult moments? Our email address, update@kcur.org. Lori from Overland Park, good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
Mine's a little bit different topic in that when a college-age kid comes home and they've been living on their own and, you know, trying to be real independent, and they come home and maybe the independence hasn't gone so well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, they don't want to hear advice from mom and dad. I'm just kind of curious what you would recommend as to how to cope with some of those tensions.
Well, I think that's so on topic. I think that
yeah,
is
you're
really
right there, Lori.
A common problem. And, you know, you'll get kind of the really functional ones who are asserting that independence and, you know, wanting to go with their French boyfriend to New York for the holidays. Then you get the ones who are coming home and are really behaving kind of childishly. And one of the difficult problems you have is in the transition from adolescence to adulthood, people have all these yearnings for freedom and not a whole lot of skill at independence. And so depending on how severe the problem is, if it's something you can kind of let go, you don't like the dating partner or something, you kind of try not to pick a fight. But if somebody's, grades roll in, that's the joyful thing about Christmas. Grades roll in.
About the same time.
What a gift under the tree that is, mm-hmm. in some situations. Then, I don't recommend people start trouble during the holidays. It's better, mm-hmm. to say, let's talk about that after it's over, after the holidays are over, and we'll sit down and discuss what makes sense. And there's a whole show we ought to do sometime on this issue about what do you do with the failing college student. There is a whole set of strategies people need to think through on the failing college student, and people struggle with that quite a bit.
But if grades fall the next few days, you're suggesting just maybe put that topic off till after the holiday.
I think that there is nothing to be gained. The most important issue, and Harriet Lerner talked about this when she was on your show last week, is manage emotional reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
Manage emotional reactivity on situations in the holidays. And you just don't want to finish Christmas carols and say, why did you get an F in organic chemistry?
Yeah,
this is not pleasant. So go ahead. You've got enough time over Christmas break for college students to wait until January and after New Year's and sit down and say, okay, let's go over our New Year's resolution to do better in school and see what's doable for that.
Well, that does sound reasonable in most situations, and I just don't know that she'll be here that long. She might be, because she's got her own place, and so you just hate to see them fail, and it's by their own admission that they take on more than they can handle.
True. Would you say she's failing because she took on too much, or she's not following through on a reasonable amount of?
No, I think she takes on way too much. She's kind of always had that tendency to take on way too much, and then she has a personal relationship, a boyfriend that has issues, and the personal life is also adversely affecting the academic life, and it's really hard to watch them. But I try real hard not to say too much.
Yeah, how do you manage that, Lori?
I don't do it real well, but, what can I say? You try to let them grow up and learn the hard way, but it's so hard. It's so hard.
I just think you bring up such an important point, Lori, and I'm going to look down the road with Steve and Stephen here and see a month we can do that toward the end of next semester, because that's when the problems hit the fan in the spring, is about April or so, and we probably really ought to talk about how to make decisions. Some folks are in college that ought to not be there. We have a 40% dropout rate in college because we want to send everybody, and then we're not sure how to keep them there.
We have a 40% dropout rate in college?
We send more kids to college than any other industrialized nation in the world, and we drop more out per capita than any other nation in the world.
We should have that conversation sometime. That's just breathtaking.
You just generated a show, Lori. You're an important part of our day.
Well, thanks. I hope it helps. But I'll do what I can to get through the next week or so. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Lori.
Thank you. You too.
You know, Wes, how much should kids be expected to be, present at holiday gatherings, and how much should they be allowed time to themselves? Because, the folks travel a long ways to see, them, and they want to be on their phones or, out with their buddies.
Or asleep,
yeah. Right. And it gets very tricky very quickly.
Yeah. Again, there is I think you have to sort of manage expectations and let people be who they are, but also help young people to see that they have some obligation to their families. They do need to spend some time with family, and if you can work to be inclusive of them and the friend or the boyfriend or whatever, then they really ought to not have a big complaint because you're making your compromise. I think that for a lot of kids, the Christmas break, holiday break is time to rest and sleep and hang out with friends. And
maybe deservedly so.
And deservedly.
As we just talked, finals are going on this week and kids are pretty wound up.
Exactly. And they need that. But I think that doesn't mean parents need to be, doormats and kids run the show. So the more that the discussion can be had are what are reasonable rules, not only for personal conduct, but for involvement with the family, and negotiate that out a little bit, everybody will have a happier time. Too often feelings get hurt both ways, and people don't want to come home anymore for the holiday. And how's that fix anybody's problem. Mm-hmm. It's not good at all.
Well, again, it sounds like you deal with this a lot in, mm-hmm. in your practice. You're hearing about these issues already this time
all
of year.
All week.
All week long.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so your best advice for keeping the holidays on track for everybody would be, again, it sounds like having this conversation, if not now, if, you know, you should have had it by now, but have it pretty soon here.
Well, and think it through. Think through, not just react emotionally to things. This can be a really good experience, and there are things you could, for example, say to your child, I understand you don't want to do Christmas Day with us. You want to be at your boyfriend's house, mm-hmm. you know, down the road. Might we go and have a dinner together? You could invite him so we do something family-like on Christmas Eve or, you know, in the evening on Christmas, figuring out how do we work this all in together. And interestingly enough, people who have healthy divorces are really used to doing this. They know about how you have to schedule it or, you know, transition the kids. And I think sometimes they handle this better because they are used to doing it. Whereas people who've never had that have this very cohesive, you know, nuclear family, and they just can't. It's painful to let that go.
You're saying that for some families, they're like all cocooned inside an egg, and
correct.
You can't look at it that way. At some point, you got to crack the egg.
Yeah, the purpose of – I've said this before. The purpose of parenting is to get fired by your best customers. This is what your job is. Mm-hmm. It's like being a therapist. You know, I want to get fired by people who are satisfied with my work. And so you ought to not be clinging. You should be embracing this new young adult. And as our last caller, Lori, said, sometimes that's hard because the young adult is doing things that aren't as productive for themselves as you think they should be.
Mm-hmm.
In general, being a good advisor, being a supportive advisor at that point will help kids more than trying to scare them or be disappointed in them all the time and so on. So yeah. You want to try to really find a balance on that.
Yeah. Well, Wes, always good to have you here. Thanks for taking time with us as always.
You bet.
That psychologist Wes Crenshaw, you can find our previous conversations with him as well as more information about our broadcast at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow we'll hear about the best children's literature in 2012, and we'll also have our weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.